Well, good morning, everyone. So this morning, we have a couple of exciting talks ahead. Most of you will know Beatrice Valverde, because she's presented to the festival in the past. She's an assistant professor at the University of Universidad de Jaén. And I had to ask Ramon for coaching, and then I lost my nerve and asked Beatrice for coaching. Duolingo is not that valuable. And so she is the collaborator with Father Mark Bosco on a book about Flannery O'Connor, and she's currently working on a critical edition of the commonplace book that Graham Greene gave to Father Duran. And so this morning she's going to talk to us about journalism. So hand it over there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard, for this kind introduction and for inviting me to be here these days. And, you know, because it's wonderful to be back and spend, you know, some days with, like, a group of people that I consider, like, my friends already. So, like, you know, it's really wonderful to be here. The title of my presentation is, as you can see here, is, like, Guarding the Fourth Power, Fictional Representations of Journalistic Practice, Malpractice in Graham Greene's Fiction. This is my current other project, actually. You know, like I'm working in the final stages of a book that will have like a similar title to this and will probably come out like at the beginning of 2025. Well, first, like I will give you like some you know, background information on why and you know. Greene as a journalist and his concerns about the media. Then I will try to analyze like some characters, you know, only three because like we have the time that we have, you know. And I will finish with some final remarks. The name of Graham Greene, as you all know, as a writer, is closely connected both in scholarly research and popular imagination with his spiritual and political concerns, as well as with the craft of the thriller and the world of espionage. In different international journalistic media, Greene has usually been and is still labeled a Catholic writer, as you all know, grappling with the meaning of faith. In addition, and in line with the recent re-emergence of the thriller as a genre, his name is often mentioned together with those of John Le Carré, Elmer Mendoza, or Daniel Silva, among others, as a must-to-read writer. In this vein, references to Greene are also found in popular culture, such as in television series, in connection with the aforementioned themes. Interestingly, in Two Cathedrals, second season finale of The West Wing, President Josiah Bartlett, Martin Sheen, has a grudge against God after Mrs. Landingham dies in a car accident, if you remember. Or don't know if you have watched the series. I highly recommend you to do it if you haven't. In his interaction with God after the burial in Washington, D.C. Cathedral, he quotes with bitter irony the words that the priest says to Rose at the end of Brighton Rock. And let me see if I can, yeah, or maybe you can do it from there.
You're a son of a bitch, you know that? She bought her first new car and you hit her with a drunk driver. What? Is that supposed to be funny? You can't conceive, nor can I, the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God, says Graham Greene. I don't know whose ass he was kissing there, because I think you're just vindictive.
He was not happy, right, that at that moment, at least. With anyhow, it's not the only case. Another example worth mentioning, like, is season six finale of Homeland, like much recent, you know, more recent series, entitled America First. In it, thank you. Dar Adal, if you remember, says to Saul, quote, "You remember what Graham Greene said, don't you? The Secret Services are the only real measure of a nation's political health, the one true expression of its subconscious." So as you can see, in popular culture, religion, spiritual issues, right? And of course, like, the spy world. So are the references, you know, connected to Green. As far as scholarly studies are concerned, even though Green has been one of the most analyzed and discussed authors of the 20th century, according to scholars like Elliot Malamet or Baldrige Cates, much of this scholarship remains redundant. On this note, among other topics, scholarship has not paid enough attention to how journalism and the media function in Green's works, with only a few studies addressing the elements of the practice of media in his literary writing. This is precisely the topic I'm currently, you know, working on, as I told you. When we think of Green's characters in terms of professions, like, probably the first ones that come to our minds are spies, police officers, revolutionaries, and writers, and of course, priests. Well, if we can consider priesthood a profession. Readers may mention journalists, thinking of Thomas Fowler, of course, in The Quiet American, but few would be aware of the vast collection of journalists in Green's works. Let's carry out like a little experiment, if you want, here. Try, you know, with someone else, like sitting next to you or in groups of three or something, try to think of, you know, journalists in Green's fiction. I will give you a couple of minutes, and then let's see how many you can come up with.
Yes, the Mabel Warren. Yes, Charles Hale from Bright Rock, Minty from England.
Count.
The Quiet American, of course. From there, I don't know. That, all his early stuff has a lot of early stuff.
No, because he's a journalist. He's a journalist who goes to the interviews. That's always benefits. I'm not sure he's giving you a name.
Is there anything done for Sam? More confidential agent, I don't think. In that first time. Well, when he's working for me. Yeah, Minty. That's all right. Yes, it's the guy who interviews. What's his name? It's in the affair. Yeah, interviews. Yes, we interviewed Bendrix about his craft of the novel in the book, and that's great. He's secretary, and then you often feel the other. I can't remember his name. He's a comedian. Nothing in power before.
So, how many could you, like, did you count? Three, six, six, five. We're going to talk about this, like, in the, so yeah, we'll see. Okay, so six, seven, like, good job. I'm impressed. Well, just for you to know, There are 49 characters in total who are in the business of the printing press, either as journalists or as editors. Maybe you were, you know, not paying attention to editors.
That was a trick question.
Twice. However, I mean, what is relevant, you know, to me is not the extensive number of reporters, but Green's deep analysis of their ethical or unethical methods and the impact of their professional behavior in their social environment. In our current model of information society, citizens face serious challenges trying to discern which information is based on verified facts and which has been, to some extent, manipulated or simply created to disseminate disinformation that will cause confusion among the public concerning specific issues, right? This has become a global concern for all of us, and well, not a day goes by without a reference in the media to George Orwell's 1984 as the book to read, you know, a work that is as relevant as ever. Well, I mean, even reckoning the unquestionable significance of Orwell's masterpiece, there is life beyond Orwell, you know. In our understanding of our current society regarding information control and dissemination, Graham Greene's fictional representation of journalistic practices is essential. What is more, Greene's depiction constitutes an epistemic source of the ethics of the profession. As we all know, Greene pursued a professional career as a journalist before he became a full-time writer. After he left the Times, he continued taking on reporting assignments as a correspondent for a variety of publications. Greene knew the profession inside out, and the role of the media in shaping the public's views through information gathering and dissemination was among his main concerns. Even though the analysis of journalistic practices in terms of dissemination of information is crucial, Greene's fictional depiction of reporters goes farther in examining the profession regarding two more topics. The first one, you know, the disinformation that we were talking about, but there are two more, okay? The first, the journalistic practices in connection with the classic paradigm of objectivity and detachment versus commitment and empathy, right? We all think of Thomas Fowler, like, in that sense, but it's not the only one, you know? Like, there are issues with detachment versus empathy, you know, in journalism, in pretty much all the characters. And the second one is the relationship between the journalists and their readership's expectations, as well as the importance of fostering a critical mind among the public. Well, today, due to time restraints, again, I will focus on his questioning of the misuse of power when gathering and disseminating information by journalists, editors, and the news corporation owners, and its effects on public opinion. But, like, for you to take, you know, into consideration or to bear in mind that there are two other topics to pay attention to. I don't know if you are familiarized with the third, point here, caveat lector, that's Latin, yeah? It's like, beware, right? So it's like more our responsibility as like citizens, you know, of what, concerning what we read. So that's also present, you know, in his work. Okay, so the host of El Intermedio, who you can see here, El Intermedio is an info show in Spain, broadcast after the evening news on a national TV channel. I mean, in the line of the Tonight show starring Jimmy Fallon, for you to have an idea, right? So he opens the program ironically, saying every single night, "You already know the news, now we will tell you the truth." In our current social scenario, the notion of truth in connection with the role of media informing the public has suffered some serious questioning, compromising public trust. Okay? No? No? No. What is more, as Kovács and Rosenstiel argue, in the 21st century, the thought that journalists can arrive at a truthful account of events following an objective method of verification seems rather eroded in the public mind. This idea, and I quote, amounts to a threat not only to the notion of journalism, but also to the possibility of civil societies confronting and solving its problems. The public sphere becomes an arena solely for polarized debate, not for compromise, consensus, and solution. End of quote. As a result, in the present social context, fake news, news intentionally and verifiably false, whose goal is to mislead the public, has become a global concern. According to the report of the Center for the Study of Media, Communication and Power of King's College London, the production of fake news is not, however, a new phenomenon, as we can think. Actually, it is centuries old. As Martin Moore observes in this report, the political, economical, and social motivations for creating fake or highly distorted news have existed since the invention of the printing press. As examples, Moore mentions pamphlets published during the English Civil War, in which each side made unfounded political claims against the other side, or inflated or invented news published to boost the circulation of the yellow press during the late 18th century. In Moore's words, and I quote, "The difference between this and the current phenomenon of fake news is chiefly with respect to its extent, its dissemination, and its effects." End of quote. Nowadays, fake news is disseminated rapidly and widely by means of both texts and images. It takes advantage of the modern means of mass communication, including online social media, to influence public opinion, as we all know. As a seasoned journalist, Green's concerns regarding the profession and its ethics are closely related to the principles of independence, verification of facts, and accuracy. His letters to the editors of different newspapers throughout his life expressed these preoccupations and his attitude towards the unethical practices of many of his fellow journalists is highly critical. Enlightening in this sense is Green's remark in Ways of Escape about the media, quote, "a word that has come to mean bad journalism," end of quote. Green gives voice to his concerns about unethical practices in journalism through reporters that are used to criticize the practice of the profession and more broadly of the media. In this sense, the paradox that constitutes a key to Green's thinking, the virtue of disloyalty, informs his fictional representation of journalistic practices in connection to the principles of independence, accuracy, and verification of facts. Green used this term for the first time in his exchange of letters with V.S. Pritchett and Elizabeth Bowen, published under the title Why Do I Write?, and expanded on it in his address upon receiving the Shakespeare Prize at the University of Hamburg in 1969. In this illuminating speech, Green warned against blind loyalty, arguing that the writer's genuine duty towards society was to challenge the dominant discourse of religious and political culture. In this vein, we can say that Green's fictional representation of journalism in his literary work constitutes a piece of grit in the machinery of the Western press, questioning the political and cultural dominant narrative conveyed to the public. Moreover, fictional representations in Green's novels of journalistic manipulation of information can be read as indicators and, in turn, shapers of the Western culture prevailing perceptions of the reported news and the professionals that convey the facts to a general public. As mentioned before, and in line with the question like Kevin was asking me before, The corpus of the novels, plays, and short stories in which journalistic practices are depicted is extensive. As for novels and plays, I should mention Rumour and Nightfall, Istanbul Train, It's a Battlefield, England Made Me, The Quiet American, The Potting Shed, A Burnt Out Case, The Comedians, and The Captain and the Enemy. In addition, there are other novels and short stories which feature minor characters who are aware journalists, or in which the role of the media informing the public is relevant. For example, A Gun for Sale, The Honorary Consul, and the short stories The Blessing and An Appointment with the General. The presence of journalists in this broad range of works from the beginning to the final stage of Green's literary career confirms his concern about the influence of the media in shaping public opinion and about the importance of following the code of ethics of journalism in the practice of the profession. Again, due to time restrictions, I will focus my attention today on just three characters. Mabel Warren in Istanbul Train, Thomas Fowler in The Quiet American, and Parkinson in A Burnt Out Case. These characters provide us with a range of diverse professional performances, ethically speaking, that illustrate rigorous practices, but also malpractices in journalism. Among the fictional journalists present in the corpus of Green's novels, Thomas Fowler, the protagonist of The Quiet American, is the only one that embraces the principles of ethical journalism and professional rigor. He embodies the set of standards that are at the basis of traditional objectivity: factuality, fairness, non-bias, independence, non-interpretation, and finally, and more controversial, neutrality and detachment. Fowler is a traditional journalist, a classic war correspondent in the early 1950s, who faces the atrocities of war from a clear stance. A sublimation of objectivity rules his professional performance. In this sense, he states, I quote, "The job of a reporter is to expose and to record. His function must be limited to register the events as they occur without expressing any opinion or getting involved in the reality he witnesses. Moreover, Fowler meets the demands of factuality since he regards it as a war correspondent's duty to be involved in the fight, in the fighting at first hand, for, quote, if one writes about the war, self-respect demands that occasionally one share the risks," end of quote. In his necessity to verify facts, Fowler travels to the front, putting his own life at risk, and there he witnesses firsthand death, suffering, and pain. And here we have probably two of the... Yeah, that was the one. I'm sorry about that. Two of the most famous, quotations from the novel in terms of, his reporting, Fowler's reporting, right, the chronicles. So the canal was full of bodies. I'm reminded now of an Irish stew containing too much meat. The bodies overlapped, one head seal gray, and anonymous as a convict with a shaven scalp, stuck up out of the water like a boy. There was no blood. I suppose it had flowed away a long time ago. I have no idea how many there were. And then, 20 yards beyond the farm buildings in a narrow ditch, we came on what we sought, a woman and a small boy. They were very clearly dead. A small neat clot of blood on the woman's forehead, and the child might have been sleeping. He was about 6 years old, and he lay like an embryo in the womb with his little bony knees drawn up. The image is terrible, obviously. Despite Fowler's moral dilemmas, he insists on the value of remaining detached. I'm not involved, I repeat it. It had been an article of my creed. My fellow journalists called themselves correspondents. I preferred the title of reporter. I wrote what I saw. I took no action, even an opinion if a kind of action. End of quote. The principles on which he bases his professional performance affect also his political views. Quote, isms and ocracies, give me facts. A rubber planner beats his laborer. All right, I'm against him. He hasn't been instructed to do it by the minister of the colonies. In France, I expect he'd beat his wife. I've seen a priest, so poor he hasn't a change of trousers, working 15 hours a day from hut to hut in a cholera epidemic, eating nothing but rice and salt fish, saying his mass with an old cup, a wooden platter. I don't believe in God, and yet I'm for that priest. End of quote. Contrary to some of his fellow journalists, searching for truth is fundamental for Fowler in his professional role, and he criticizes those who do not meet the demand of verifying the facts before communicating the news. As he tells Pyle, and I quote again, I even believe what I report, which is more than most of your correspondents do. End of quote. He insists on criticizing his American colleagues for the same reason. Quote, I haven't noticed much regard for the truth or for truth in our papers either. End of quote. Now, tellingly, Fowler admires Dominguez, who works for him, because he shares with him the importance of searching for honest truth. Quote, all that you encountered in daily contact with him was gentleness and humility and an absolute love of truth. Perhaps truth and humility go together. So many lies come from our pride. In my profession, a reporter's pride, the desire to file a better story than the other man's, and it was Dominguez who helped me not to care, to withstand all those telegrams from home asking why I had not covered so-and-so's story or the report of someone else, which I knew to be untrue. I was less capable than Dominguez of telling truth from falsehood, and so I formed the habit of calling in on him in the evenings to discuss what I had heard. End of quote. Within the selected corpus of Green's journalists, therefore, Fowler represents the kind of reporter who, despite his creed of the detachment, follows rigorously the principles of ethical journalism. He tells what he has experienced firsthand, verifies facts, and does not take sides. He says, again, quote, I'll be still reporting whoever wins. In this vein, Fowler distances himself from the professional performance of some of his colleagues, as we will see. Journalists, however, are not always rigorous when informing about events in the world. Who would think? Sometimes the information they convey does not reflect what actually happened, and this may have serious consequences on the prevailing views that public opinion takes on the matter. There are diverse reasons for this partial or total lack of veracity, related to the ethics of journalists themselves, extrinsic factors that affect the message, conveyed, mainly the political line or the agenda, right, of the owner, of the editor of the media, or the expectations of the readers. As Hatton argues, Green's journalists, and I quote, are portrayed not as mere recorders of facts or chronicles of day-to-day events, but as subjective authors who manufacture news and order reality to suit their own purposes. End quote. As stated before, while Fowler is the journalist that most closely embraces the principles of ethical journalism, the stories he communicates to the Western public regarding the Indochina War do not always reflect exactly the truth, mainly because his texts are censored by the French authorities. An enlightening example is his recount of the episode of the bicycle bombs. And you have here the quotation. My colleagues, except for the correspondent of the Stream Orient, who called it an outrage, knew they could only get space by making fun of the affair. Bicycle bombs made a good headline. All of them blamed the communists. I was the only one to write that the bombs were a demonstration on the part of General Te, and my account was altered in the office. The general wasn't news. You couldn't waste the space by identifying him. End of quote. In this revealing paragraph, Fowler addresses different factors that affect the way the information about the attack is communicated to the public. On the one hand, Fowler tries to point to the responsible agent for the attack, General Te, but the French authorities alter his account before sending it due to their political interests at the time, obviously. The story communicated to the media in the Western countries is also perverted in the recount sent by Fowler's colleagues. In the paragraph, it is implied that the Indochina war is old news and does not generate much interest among Western public opinion anymore. As Fowler, their colleagues know that nobody is interested in how many sites there are in this faraway war. So the presence of a new force, General Te, is not news. Consequently, Fowler's colleagues, without verifying their source of information, follow the official line, blaming the communists for the attack. What is more significant, because of its cruelty, is that the only way this attack can gain space on the newspaper's pages is to turn it into a joke under the headline Bicycle Bombs. Finally, Green's critical reflection on misleading information in this passage is completed with, at the beginning of the paragraph. The only journalist who conveys the brutality of the attack and its consequences is the correspondent of the Stream Orient. Contrary to the Western press, for him and for his readers, the people who died in the attack matter because they are not simple numbers. They are their own people, so he calls the attack an outrage. Fowler's professional performance is also affected by his newspaper's political line in several episodes throughout the novel. In this sense, there is also a sociological dimension to the use of journalists in Green's fiction as he examines the broader power structures attached to the media. In Fowler's meeting with Heng, the communist, if you remember, he finds out about Piles and consequently the American government's involvement in the development of the war. As frustrating as it may be for Hen and for himself, Fowler knows well that this information is not of interest to his newspaper. Quote, "You mean you've established a kind of connection between Pyle and the general," I said. "A very slender one. It's not news anyway. Everybody here goes in for intelligence." End of quote. Even when such connection is well established after the episode of the bombs in the public square, Fowler realizes that the general interest of the political powers in the West at the time is to blame the communists on whatever attack their press inform about. Quote, "What can I do, Heng? He's got to be stopped. You can publish the truth, or perhaps you cannot. My paper's not interested in General Te. They're only interested in your people, Han." End of quote. After witnessing firsthand the terrible consequences of these explosions and Pyle's indifference for lost human lives, Fowler finally decides to get involved in the conflict, since he's aware that as a journalist, he cannot denounce the American involvement in the massacre. However, he has no other option but to commit as a human being, getting reluctantly involved in the plot that would end up with Pyle's death. So for me, it's quite relevant that, Fowler, what Fowler cannot do as a professional, as a journalist, he has to do as a human being. Together with extrinsic factors, the journalist's personal agenda, sometimes, and interests, can also affect what events are conveyed or how they are narrated to the public. That is the case of Fowler himself, when he faces the moral dilemma of writing about what he experienced in Fat Diem. On the other hand, his professional ethics tells him, On the one hand, sorry, his professional ethics tells him he should send a report about it, but he's not ready to risk his life with Fong to communicate the story to the world. Quote, "There was nothing I could write from Fat Diem that the censors would pass. If the story had seemed good enough, I could have flown to Hong Kong and sent it from there. But was any news good enough to risk expulsion? I doubted it. Expulsion meant the end of a whole life. It meant the victory of Pyle." We find a similar scenario in one of the press conferences of the French military authorities on their last skirmish with the guerrilla. Patriotic pride in this case affects significantly the French correspondent's professional performance, since they align with the colonel in trying to hide the number of French casualties, misinforming their audience about this fact. Quote, "The French correspondents sat gloomily silent. If the American correspondents stung the colonel into an admission, they would be quick to seize it, but they would not join in bailing their countrymen." End of quote. Personal ambitions not only can lead journalists to mask or pervert information, but also to convey events to the public in a way that they bear no resemblance to reality whatsoever. These journalists put forward their own interests rather than the ethical principles that should guide their professional performance. Green's literary world offers a diverse array of such journalists in an attempt to first question this malpractice in the profession and also to make the public aware of the necessity of adopting a critical stance towards the information they receive if they do not want to be fooled. One significant example of this kind of journalist is Mabel Warren in Istanbul Train. If you remember, like, Warren is a middle-aged lesbian journalist in the 1930s who has been working as a reporter for 10 years for the London Clarion. Her career has not been brilliant so far. Quote, "Getting up at all hours, interviewing brothel keepers, mothers of murdered children, covering this and covering that. She knew with a certain pride that what they said in the London office, when you want sob stuff, sent Dizzy Mabel." Well, at the train station in Cologne, she recognizes Dr. Zinner, a former leader of the Social Democrats in Belgrade, who escaped the country some years before. Even though Zinner travels under a fake identity and simulates knowing nothing about the story, Warren is convinced that he is coming back to lead an uprising against the government. In this encounter, she sees the opportunity of, quote, "an exclusive bill page story, not a story which only the penny papers would trouble to print, but a story which the Times correspondent himself would give a year of life to know," end of quote. As a consequence of it, her career would boost, and she would get a higher salary that would help her to keep Janet, her ambitious companion, by her side. Warren seems to be the kind of journalist who verifies the facts, at least when she considers the story to be important enough. The task that took her to the station in the first place, an interview with the writer Queen Savory, is clearly not significant to her. Quote, You don't think I need to ask him questions. Just a look at him and I will put the right words in his mouth. And he won't complain either. It's publicity." End of quote. With Zinner's story, however, she acts differently at the beginning. She's a tough journalist who knows her job. She's portrayed as a news hound who untiringly searches for the story behind Zinner's return to Belgrade. Warren tells Janet, quote, I've never failed yet. You'll invent something? No, that's good enough for Savory, but not for him. She said viciously, I'll make him speak, somehow, between here and Vienna. I've got nearly 12 hours. I'll think of a way. You see, no empathy whatsoever there either, right? It's not only Fowler. She does fail this time, however. So concerned is she with getting her exclusive story that she begins to care less and less about following the principles of objectivity in her professional performance and becomes a journalist with little regard for the truth. Ironically, it is Zinner himself who breaks the news to her of the failed uprising before his arrival to Belgrade, and given his refusal to give her an exclusive interview, so there is no interview, she fabricates two versions of the non-existent interview depending on where exactly Zinner gets off the train, Vienna or Belgrade. And now we have a very long quotation, but I promise it's relevant. Okay, it's like the phone call that Mabel, she calls Edwards, in his office, in the newspaper office, to give him, to dictate to him the report, the supposed interview, the two versions of the supposed interview, right? The two versions are in brown, and the rest is just the conversation they have. Okay. I will try to read it in the proper way. Let's see. Hello, is that the London Clarion, Edwards? Right, get this on. This is your Bill Page lead, and you've got to hold it for a half an hour. If I don't ring you up again, shoot it off. The communist outbreak at Belgrade, which was put down with some loss of life on Wednesday night, as reported in our later editions yesterday, was planned by the notorious agitator, Dr. Richard Zinner. He was believed to have been murdered by government agents, but although a warrant was out for his arrest, he escaped. And in an exclusive interview with our special correspondent, described his life as a schoolmaster at Great Bridgeton-on-Sea. Note to the news editor, can't get him to speak about this, get the dope from the headmaster. His name's John. The outbreak at Belgrade was untimely. It had been planned for Saturday night, by which time Dr. Zinner, who left England on Wednesday evening, would have arrived in the capital and taken control. Dr. Zinner learned of the outbreak and its failure when the express by which he was traveling reached Würzburg and immediately decided to leave the train at Vienna. He was heartbroken and could only murmur over and over again to our special correspondent, if only they had waited. He was confident that if he had been present in Belgrade, the whole working class of the city would have supported the rising. In broken accents, he gave our correspondent the amazing tale of his escape from Belgrade in 1927 and described the plans now prematurely ruined. Got that? Now listen carefully. If you don't get the rest of the dope in half an hour, cancel everything after reached Würzburg and continue as follows. And after a long and painful hesitation, decided to continue his journey to Belgrade. He was heartbroken and could only murmur, those fine, brave fellows, how can I desert them? When he had a little recovered, he explained to our special correspondent that he had decided to stand his trial with the survivors, thus living up to the quixotic reputation he gained for himself. End of the quote. Revealing, isn't it? Warren communicates in her article a fabricated version of Zinner as a person and of his reaction to the news of the uprising. As an experienced journalist, she possesses an intuitive knowledge of what the readers of the Clarion will want. With that in mind, she intentionally introduces dramatic tones to her story, since the more dramatic the story, the higher the sales. Warren is perfectly aware as well of the power that the media has in shaping the public's perception of the world. As she herself states, quote, public opinion's just another name for the Clarion, end of quote. Moreover, she knows that with the rising of mass media in the 1930s, citizens have just become consumers of news rather than critical readers, masses with gargantuan appetite for the written word, people who cannot wait to have their fill of words along with the breakfast they eat, words that journalists strive against time to supply ceaselessly. Warren tells Savory, quote, we are not a weekly paper. Our public can wait, hungry, for its Nyon steak, No time for proofs. People in London will be reading the interview while they eat their breakfast tomorrow, end of quote. Her knowledge of the profession does not lead her, however, to practice unethical journalism. Instead of communicating verified information to her readers, she offers them fake news for breakfast. Another journalist in Green's literary world who has lost his professional vocation is Parkinson in a Barn Todd case. Together with Granger in The Quiet American, Parkinson is the journalist portrayed in a less favorable light in Green's fiction. Both make up stories to feed their audiences, and neither of them feels ashamed when they recognize that they do so. Granger, who at one time wrote articles worthy of the Pulitzer, now says publicly about his coverage of the Indochina War, quote, "Stephen Crane could describe a war without seeing one. Why shouldn't I?" End of quote. Parkinson, on the other hand, knows as well as Mabel Warren that the audience from the Western world expect to read, and even though he experiences firsthand the situation of the continent, his chronicles continue conveying the image of Africa created by the Victorian writers and explorers. Quote, Parkinson said, "Can you use a camera? Would you do me a favor and take some pictures of me carried ashore? Get as much atmosphere as you can. You know the kind of thing. Black faces gathered around, looking worried and sympathetic. What do you want the picture for? It's the kind of thing they like to have. You can't distrust a photograph, or so people think. Oh, well, if I hadn't had this malaria, I dare say I'd have had to invent it. It gives the right touch." End of quote. He keeps mentioning Henry Morton Stanley in his articles despite Carey's geographical corrections. Quote, "Stanley was never here," Carey said. "I don't care whether he was or not." End of quote. If Warren showed little regard for the truth, Parkinson shows none. He fabricates a false saintly image of Carey for his readers, even though Dot Collins accuses him of lying. Quote, "But these are lies," Collins said to Father Thomas. "What's the grousing about?" Parkinson asked. "He says that what you have written there is not altogether true." "Tell him it's more than the truth," Parkinson said. "It's a page of modern history. Do you really believe Caesar said, 'Et tu, Brute'? It's what he ought to have said, and someone on the spot, all Herodotus, no, he was the Greek, wasn't he? It must have been like someone else, like Suetonius, perhaps, spotted what was needed. The truth is always forgotten. My articles have to be remembered like history, at least from one Sunday to another." End of quote. Oh, that was it. Okay. In disinforming the audience, Parkinson has the same objective as Warren, to sell more copies of the newspaper. Quote, "It's a small mistake in geography, that's all. One has to dramatize. It's the first thing they teach a reporter on the Post. He has to make every story stand up. Anyway, no one will notice." End quote. Parkinson, as the rest of the journalists in the novels, is aware of the powerful role of the media in society. And after building Carey up, he warns him, quote, "History's just as likely to make my interpretation as your own. I told you I was going to build you up, Carey. Unless, of course, as now seems likely, I find it makes a better story if I pulled you down." End of quote. Furthermore, Parkinson knows that the media is the only way for citizens to have access to what happens in the world. However, instead of acknowledging his mistake about Stanley or any geographical mistake and conveying accurate information to his readers, Parkinson just says, quote, "They won't know the bloody difference," end of quote. In this sense, whereas Warren or Granger do not show much respect for their audience, Parkinson goes farther, despising the public, since for him, they are just gullible consumers of news without any critical thinking. I felt offended. I don't know about you. My final remarks, even though The phenomenon of fake news is not new, as we said. It has turned into a worrying concern in our current social scenario. In this vein, among Green's interests in his novels was to critically reflect on the unprecedented influence of the media at the time. His observations of journalistic malpractice are crucial to an understanding of the representation in his work of a media-dominated world. In this sense, Green provides the reader with a critical view of the profession through the performance of different characters, while Fowler usually embraces the code of ethics of journalism. With Granger, Mabel Warren, Parkinson, journalism is at its worst, an art of the demagogue and the despot. Green was aware of the influence of journalism as a medium, a message and a discourse influencing the way individuals see, talk about, understand, and experience world events. With his fictional representation of the profession, Green advocates the significance of the virtue of disloyalty in the practice of journalism. In Green's words, a journalist must be, quote, faithful to the notion of respecting the truth and mustn't on any account set out with preconceived ideas of giving his allegiance to the paper which employs him, end of quote. In his work, Green shows, like his readership, how information can be manipulated and highlights the necessity of developing a critical mind concerning the news we consume. In this sense, therefore, Green's literary work acts as the guardian of the role of the press, the fourth estate in the Western society. Thank you very much for listening.
Beatrice, thank you so much for a very insightful and timely a commentary on the living relevance of Graham Greene's writings, especially in this respect. I'm wondering, do we have some questions? Would people like to pose some? I'm going to ask. Now, Paul, we need to use the microphone.
Hi, Beatrice. Thank you very much for your analysis of Green and sort of journalism here. And I'm curious if you're familiar with a sort of recent conceptualization of history and theory in the 21st century called post-truth.
Yes.
Have you encountered? Okay, great. Because I've written a bit about post-truth, and I find it fascinating. And the fact that I think Green is sort of, especially in The Quiet American, is kind of tapping into what Hannah Arendt called defactualization. As she was talking about the Vietnam War specifically there. And I was just wondering if what your work, you said you're working on a book of this, if you are trying to situate Green, are you predicting or responding to these sort of post-truth issues today?
Yeah, the issue again when predicting and, like to me, it's not that much predicting, it's that the human being is not that original. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like we experience like similar scenarios at different times, you know, like so even though we cannot compare obviously the explosion of like the printing news, you know, the printing business like in the 1930s, you know, with what is going on right now, but there are certain similarities in the sense that, you know, like a lot more people after the education reform, right, at the end of the 19th century, could read, you know, and that everyone was interested in, like, you know, like, you know, what was going on everywhere, and everyone was reading newspapers, and newspapers are all over the novels. It's not only the characters, it's like the headlines and newspapers everywhere. So, like, taking advantage, you know, of that explosion, and it's like and not having a critical mind on the part of the readers, you know, journalists, as Parkinson, you know, not all were, obviously, not all are the same, not all were the same, but, you know, Green is telling us, you know, there are people like this, you know, and that they will, they don't care about the truth, they just care about, like, selling, you know, newspapers, and they think that you are, like, gullible, like, you know, and that you don't care about the difference. Right. So, you know, I think that is very related to what is happening, you know, like right now. That's the reason why in the book I'm trying to connect, and that I think I'm responding to your question with that.
Yeah,
like, you know, what happened then and what we are experiencing. And that's the reason why at the very beginning I said, like, even though the media, you know, always talk about Orwell, you know, as the book is, it's like, go to me, you know, there's more. Just like, anyhow.
I'm wondering if Green's emphasis on always telling the truth also followed him, and he thought the same way when he started to work for the Ministry of Information at the beginning of the Second World War. As I understand it, one of its objectives was to produce a version of the truth that would buck up the English public. Would you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, without any doubt, like, there are, like, controversies, you know, even in the way, like, he acted as, like, when, you know, he was in that situation. And also in his work as a journalist, you know, like, the different, like, chronicles and reports he published, like, throughout his life. If we have to believe, you know, like, it's a big if maybe, like, what he said about it, you know, it's like he was always in an honest search for the truth in his role as a journalist. But, you know, like, in different times of his life, you know, was he acting as a journalist or not? Maybe that's a question. I don't know. And we cannot know, probably, you know.
Thank you very much. I was just going to say that the process by which the foreign correspondent's submission to his paper is altered back at head office was quite close, as I'm sure you know, to Graham, because his brother Hugh was a foreign correspondent in Germany and wrote reports on the concentration camps some years before the war. And they were edited out by the paper, which wished to be in associated with appeasement. I'm not quite sure what the most of it, but around that.
Yeah, that happens like a number of times, and he was like really, really angry when they altered their, like, you know, his letters to the press or something. Like, extremely, you know, like, there are letters there, you know, correspondence between editors and Green and saying, like, so, yeah, definitely.
Just very briefly, because I'm clock watching, an observation. That was fantastic.
I really thank you.
Really, and I look forward to the book. Just an observation, going back to Fowler, I think you quote him saying sometimes, particularly as a war reporter, you need to share in the danger a little bit. Now, Richard and Mike and others in the room can correct me. I think Graham Greene himself, by his own admission, was a bit of a coward, and that he didn't always like to put himself in danger. And he said somewhere, I think, that the only two places his life really felt imperiled were A, Fat Ziem, when he went 1951-ish and recorded the bodies in the canals and so on, and the other one I don't know the context of, but he said it was something to do with he got caught up in a fascist black shirt riot, which presumably would be Cannon Street. Okay. So those were the only two occasions. Anyway, given that the real Graham Greene was a little bit queasy about risking his life, despite the Russian roulette business and that, but it's merely an observation. He goes to Fat Ziem, Graham Greene, on the back of being very miserable with Catherine Woolston. He's travelled half the world to get away from her. Her husband's now saying that you can't, you know, see Graham. There must be a six-month sabbatical. And he writes to Catherine Woolston, tomorrow I'm going looking for a bullet. And so, in other words, if Catherine Woolston had made him happy, he probably wouldn't have gone to Fat Ziem. If he hadn't gone to Fat Ziem, we wouldn't have had some of the most graphic and important, not just fictional representations, but actual representations of what war in the raw is all about. So that's why, even yesterday when I said the book is dedicated to René Berval and Fong, I always see The Quiet American as a Catherine Woolston book.
Do you want to say anything about that?
I think
Catherine Walson issue was immense, and you're going to deal with that. If I can just sort of go off on an edge, I can think of other instances when his life was really in danger, like the Six-Day War, and Liberia was bad.
Hmm.
And also, right at the end, he went to the border of Honduras during the Contour War, and where people were getting killed about one a day, and he felt very uneasy about approaching the border, and was in a Land Rover that had no escape if they were, and also the truck on the hillside in Kenya, he was with the district commissioner, and the thing almost went over the edge, and the other time when he had the rhinoceros. There's a few instances, but then again,
do you accept that broadly he was a bit queasy though about putting himself in danger, but danger came to him nonetheless?
I think he went towards it, and then when the moment came, it was, oh my God, I really don't want to be here. when he went into Haiti in 65, was it? He was really super uncomfortable there and was glad to get out of it. So, you know, the addiction, the danger was perhaps qualified. I'm sorry, did Nick, you
have a question? I was just going to say, on the Bernard Diedrich, Bernard Diedrich was worried he was putting himself in great danger when he was parading around the border.
Yes,
that's in full range of a bullet. He didn't feel threatened, but Bernard Diedrich thought he was, and he was pretty experienced. So.
The Six-Day War example, Green said something like, I'm getting rather too old for this.
Yeah.
And that's 1967, was it? Which implied that he thought there was a part of his life where he was up for doing that kind of thing, but, you know, I'm too old now. But he continued to do it.
Yeah.
Of course, danger is a funny thing for journalists, isn't it? Yeah. Let me give it back to you. Or is there anything you further want?
No.
We're almost ready for coffee. Someday I have to tell you folks about my experience with Bernard in a rock-throwing riot. Or two of them, actually. I'll tell it really quickly. One, we were driving down a road somewhere out of Port-au-Prince to the other end of the island, and there was some kind of a demonstration going on. People were throwing rocks, and he's indifferent. A bunch of police come with rubber bullet guns, run past our car, which is in a traffic jam, and he says, it's nothing. The minute the police come, they'll disperse. And they did.
Poof.
Okay, next day, we're driving in downtown Port-au-Prince, and there's a meeting of Central American leaders going on. And he spots something down the road, and he starts swearing in Creole at the driver, turn, turn, turn. And he saw that this was an actual riot, which if we approached, we would be in deep trouble. And so the car swerves, starts doing back, and somehow or other, by this magical sixth sense, he could tell you when danger was danger. And I'm sorry to steal the last couple of minutes there, but there's coffee available now. Thank you.